Please be sure to visit our Etsy store for some great Warrior Next Door podcast merchandise, and please consider becoming a premium subscriber. Just go to our Facebook page to sign up and receive each series uncut in its entirety.
Please join us for the final installment of the Lucky Luckadoo series, or interview, basically, that we conducted with him before Masters of the Air was even over. I think we interviewed him around episode 2, and we were really blessed to have him on our podcast. And not just him, but also the author, Kevin Maurer, who was able to write his biography. Kevin Maurer is an accomplished author in his own right. And so in this final episode, you're going to hear Lucky talk about his final mission, a variety of other thoughts about the war and being in 100th Bomb Group. And then we're gonna finish it by having a conversation with Kevin about his books and his approach to writing. So please join us. I think Kevin's done a fantastic job capturing an amazing story from John Luckadoo. What could you describe what it was like flying that last mission, and what was that mission? What was it to?
Well, the last mission, I was the acting squadron commander of the 2nd Bomb Group, or Guam Squadron, the 350th, and the commanding officer was off in a rest home with battle fatigue. So he wasn't even on the base. But at any rate, as his operations officer, I could cherry pick the missions that I flew, because that was my job, to determine who flew and in what position, particularly if your squadron was designated as the lead for the group. And this mission came up in the middle of February of 44. And I only had one mission left to fly. And it came across that it was a mission to take out a missile site on the shores of France that was lobbing V-2 missiles into London. And they had a 160-foot-long rail that they launched these missions on, these missiles on. And so I thought that would be a milk run. We'd just duck over the coast and drop our bombs and scoot home, and it would all be over. And I picked a crew that only had one mission left also, and they happened to be from Dallas, and flying Alice from Dallas.
Nice.
Two. And so I called up the pilot and said, "Bill, we only each have one mission to fly, and this is one we're going to finish up on. So it'll be a milk run, and we'll just dodge over the coast and drop our bombs and get home, and we'll be through." And he said, "I'm with you." So we took off, and the Germans knew where we were going, and they came halfway over across the channel and attack us before we could ever get to the target.
My Lord.
And shot us up pretty good, but we still managed to bomb the target and take it out and get back. And it was a short 5-hour mission, that's the way I finished up.
So what's interesting is that was on February the 13th, 1944. 2 days ago, that was exactly 80 years to the day that mission took place.
Correct.
I have some general questions about your time over there before we transition a little bit to some of the post-war stuff. What was your most memorable mission?
Well, definitely the mission that starts the book is the one to Bremen on October the 8th of 43, the beginning of Black Week. And I was flying with a new crew as an instructor. And that was the first mission that I flew after the initial crew finished up and went home. And this was the first time that we had ever witnessed the Germans flying through their own flak.
Oh.
Normally, when the flak guns opened up on the bomb run, they would lay off and wait and allow the guns to battle damage us enough to hopefully push us out of the formation. But they were flying that day through their own flak. And when they ran out of ammunition, they were so aggressive, they were ramming us.
Oh my God.
Kamikaze.
Wow.
We had never witnessed that before. And so on the bomb run, we lost 12 out of our 18 airplanes out of the formation. And I was the only element leader that was left flying. And I fired a flare, and the rest of the five airplanes that were airborne formed on me, and we managed to tack on to an ensuing wave from the 95th bomb group that had lost a squadron, and we tucked in with them, and I had lost an engine over the target and was only on three engines, so I was slowed up somewhat, and I was afraid I was going to have to drop out of the formation, because if I slowed the formation down too much, they'd stall out, and they couldn't afford that. So, but I managed to nurse it along, and I didn't really think I was going to make it back, but we managed to do so. And the operations officer of my squadron had been in the plane immediately in front of me that had been rammed and blew up. And so when I landed, the squadron commander came up to me and asked where he was. And I said, well, I saw them blow up, so I don't think anybody got out. He won't be coming back. Oh, and he said, all right, then that makes you the operations officer. So that's when I assumed ground duties in addition to still having to fly my remaining missions.
We talked about fighters earlier. We didn't get to flak. Could you... What do you remember about the flak over there?
Well, the flak was terrifying because it could be so heavy, and they could move those flak guns around on rail cars and trucks to protect their targets. They were very effective. Initially, we didn't believe that their guns could reach us at high altitude, but heck, they could go to that altitude and beyond. Without difficulty. In fact, we discovered that their guns were actually radar controlled, and they could plot our altitude and direction and wind and all of that sort of thing and electronically fire them at the right point. So all they needed was just Hitler Youth to load them. And
wow.
there were hundreds of them. They were turning out thousands of anti-aircraft guns, and they were very effective, and you couldn't defend against them. LeMay proved to us that if we tried to take evasive action, we could just as easily fly into it as away from it, and so we just simply tried to continue to fly straight and level and form a platform for our bomb drop.
Not to mention the risk that evasive action would add in mid-air collisions, you know?
Well, in formation, you can't take much evasive action anyway, but a good formation leader could vary the direction of the flight and the group just a half a degree or a full degree and throw the guns off. So because it took about 45 seconds from the time the missile would leave the muzzle and reach our altitude.
Oh, my Lord.
And we could see where they were aiming, and we could a good leader could take some action to steer away from them.
What did you fear more, the fighters or the flak?
Both. It wasn't a matter of which. We lost as many aircraft to flak as we did to fighters.
In the, you know, in various movies, whether it's Band of Brothers or Masters of the Air, they show the effect of flak on an airplane, moving the airplane up and down. Is that right? Do they get that right? Is that what it looks like when you're flying through flak?
Oh, yes. You see these black puffs, and that means that the shell has exploded, and anything with a 150 feet radius is going to get shrapnel. And it only takes a little piece of shrapnel to go through an engine or a propeller or through the tissue-thin aluminum of your fuselage. It's very dangerous. And it's a sinking feeling to realize that there's that much danger out there. But if you've seen it, the chances are you've avoided it.
Did you ever have anybody on your flight injured?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay.
Numerous times.
My understanding, again, from reading the book, but I got you here. You're right in front of me, virtually at least, that the role of the co-pilot was kind of like the manager of the plane. The pilot flew. Your job was to help him fly, but also to check in on the crew and to manage any sort of emergencies. I mean, did you ever feel overwhelmed?
Oh, absolutely. Our duties were numerous. We had to transfer fuel to try and maintain the weight and balance of the aircraft. We had to figure our remaining fuel to get home on. We had to take care of any emergencies that arose or injuries. Assign a crew member to take care of another crew member. A co-pilot was, you know, like a cat on a hot tin roof.
So we interviewed somebody from the 390th Bomb Group who flew with the 100th a lot. Mm-hmm. And his name was Alfred Kramer. And Alfred told us that they loved flying with you guys because you guys would take all the hits that the 390th almost never got hit as much as the 100th. They called you guys the Bloody 100th. And he said there was a rumor going around base, and I want to see if this is true. He said that, because remember, he came in later in the war, like, you know, after you had left, probably like June or July of 44. He said the rumor was earlier in the war, the 100th Bomb Group, someone had the idea of dropping their wheels when under attack, which was supposed to be some universal sign of, we give up, we're going to land. And when the German fighters came in to escort them, they shot the German fighters down, and it created this really vitriol between the Germans and the 100th Bomb Group. Is that BS?
It is, okay. And it's untrue. It's been proven both from the German side and the British side and the American side that it never happened.
Mm.
But it was a fanciful story. Yes, there was an unwritten code of the air with the Luftwaffe that if you knew that you were so badly damaged that you couldn't make it back home, you could surrender by lowering your wheels, and that the fighters would escort you then to the nearest aerodrome, and you'd land and be taken prisoner. And that on the Regensburg mission, which was back in August of 43, August the 17th of 1943, ostensibly, that very thing happened to a crew in the 100th. And that crew was not even in that region when that was supposedly taking place. And so... it's been thoroughly disputed and proven to be just fictional, but the rumor took legs, and every time it was repeated, it was elaborated on, and we still suffer from the onus of it to this day, and always will. But that's one of the reasons why we were called the Bloody Hundredth.
So I have a real quick question. You know, why would a crew want to drop their landing gear, land their plane, turn a B-17 over to the Germans? Rather than just bail out, let the plane crash and destroy the technology, would it be solely because maybe everyone on the plane was too wounded to be able to jump out? What would be the reason for it?
Ryan, it's strictly a matter of the circumstances, how badly injured maybe some of the crew members were, how badly shot up the airplane was. There are just so many ifs that could be factored into a situation that would justify that, that it's a decision that the pilot would have to make, depending upon what he's confronted with. And whether it's justified or not is debatable. But nevertheless, it was adhered to and was observed and actually worked. If you, instead of wanting to risk being shot down and crashed, because once you're away from the formation and you don't have any mutual protection of other ships, you're strictly on your own, and it's just a matter of time before the opposing forces will bring you down.
Okay, so I only have really one more question before we just, I have two questions, and then we'll start to wrap this up. We've had you for almost an hour and a half, and I appreciate it. I mean, question number, first one, you know, Egan and Clevin, those and Crosby, those individuals are featured pretty heavily in Masters of the Air. What are your memories about the guys that you served with? Has Masters of the Air showed their personalities pretty correctly, or what are your thoughts on it?
Well, actually, that's difficult to gauge because they don't look like that. They're not attempting to portray them physically as to how I remember them. In the first episode, I had an impossible time of even trying to identify who they were talking about. I could barely catch the names, and it wasn't until I saw a version with closed captions and could hear some of the dialogue and discern some of the dialogue that I could identify. Also, they've taken some liberties in sticking mustaches on a number of them that never had mustaches.
Oh, really?
Egan did, Harding, the commander of the group, never had one. And certainly Crosby never had one. As the series progresses, you'll be also seeing someone brought in who was really a very colorful character and a hero in even our own vernacular, and that's Rosie Rosenthal.
Yeah.
And Rosie will be portrayed in later episodes. They will also be showing, I'm told, quite a bit about the prisoner of war camp, the Luftwaffe 3, which I had no familiarity with, fortunately, at all. And so that will be all new to me. But the personalities, I know I was called from London one day by the British actor who was portraying Glenn Dye, my pilot.
Oh.
And he said, would you please let me know what his personality was.
Uh-oh.
And I said, you really want to know? And he said, yeah, because, the better we understand the individual's personality, the better we will be able to impersonate them. So I said, okay, if you're sitting down, here goes.
And again, for those who haven't read the book, read it. We're only scratching the surface here. So, what's your background? You've written books like No Easy Day and The Lions of Kandahar. I've heard of these. So what's your background?
I started as a reporter, covered the military in North Carolina. So, I was one of those embedded reporters that you heard about in Iraq, and I've been going back ever since. And so for me, there's something about writing about conflict. I'm mostly interested in the guys that have to do the missions, which is why, Lucky Story was so great, is that I'm not as interested in the generals as I am to the guy that's forced to carry out what the general thinks is a good idea.
So the ethos for The Warrior Next Door is exactly that. That's why we call it The Warrior Next Door, right? There's all kinds of books on MacArthur and Eisenhower, but the people that were there are the ones most intriguing to us. So you've had a chance to write in depth about more of the modern warfare, warfighter, and now you've had a chance to write a couple of books on World War II, obviously this one on Lucky. Could you compare and contrast maybe the experiences between what you've learned about Lucky's generation and how they fought a war and what we're seeing in some of the books you've written most recently?
Well, I mean, that's what I applaud Lucky for the most, is that he brings such a humanity to this story. And he takes some of the mythology away from it and tells you exactly how they felt, from being fearful to making some bad decisions in Newfoundland to, some of the shenanigans and that part. I think they're the same guy. I've thought a lot about this. I think the biggest difference between the veterans that I see, they all do it for the same reason. They're all doing it to be with the guy to the left and the right. Lucky flew that plane the best to his ability because he had 9 other guys counting on him to do it. Same thing with an SF team member is going to be there to make sure that the guys to his left and right survive and he does his job to the best. The one difference I find is modern veterans who grew up watching movies tell a story in a very cinematic way. The World War II generation, I find, don't tell it as a cinematic, and it takes me a little while to drag that cinema out of them.
That's interesting.
The modern guys, we're conditioned to the Spielberg, we know how to tell a story very symbolic like that.
That's amazing. I hadn't thought about that. And there's another thing that I want Lucky and Kevin to comment on. Another common theme with all the veterans we interview, doesn't matter what war it is PTS. And Lucky, you mentioned this in the book, and you talk quite a bit about how important, your wife Bobby was to helping you get over that. I'd like to hear from both you guys. We'll just start with Lucky. How did you overcome some of the post-traumatic stress that you spoke about earlier in the interview, or have you?
Well, I think the only way that I overcame it was by meeting my bride, my ultimate bride, who was intelligent enough to recognize where I didn't, that I was suffering from malaise and combat fatigue, and fortunately she was intuitive enough to know how to handle it and handle me, and instead of my sinking further and further and deeper into the morass of that kind of mental anguish, she knew how to pull me out of it, and she did. And I'm just so thankful and grateful that she crossed my path, and I had her for 71 years to counsel me and guide me and encourage me to pull myself up by my bootstraps and get with the program.
Did she ever, did you ever talk to her about these experiences? Did she ever ask you about them? Did talking about it help?
Not really. No. No, not about the experiences. What she really counseled me on, or we talked about more, was the future and our future together, and how I could grasp opportunities that came my way, and learn to say no to those that that weren't beneficial.
Yeah, and again, for our audience, please read the book. Bobby is an amazing person, an ambassador's daughter, a well-educated, well-traveled person. You're blessed to have her. I'm sorry she passed away.
And, thank
you. Or we can celebrate the fact that you had 71 amazing years with her. That's really awesome too. Kevin, when you're talking about the modern warfighters and their struggle with PTS, how can you comment on that? What have you noticed? Is there a better support group now for these guys than maybe there was back in Lucky's time?
Oh yeah. I mean, by far it's come a long way. I think no one goes over there and experiences what these guys experience and comes back unscathed. I think we're getting better at supporting them. I think one of the things is we've got to really, we put veterans on a pedestal a little bit. And I think we need to live up to what we say we're going to do, right? It's one thing to make them heroes. It's another thing to live up to the commitment of helping them. I think the stigma around mental health is getting better. It's going away. But I think you just have to, it's patience. I think we got to just understand you don't go over there and come back the same guy. I think the reason why that I've been lucky is that being able to synthesize what I did every day and write news stories about it and report it out, I think helped me quite a bit deal with what we were dealing with and seeing. I'm not sure that outlet's always there for the soldiers. And so I think giving them that space to find their outlet is big. And sometimes these books help. One of the things that I talk a lot about when I do these kind of interviews with guys, and Lucky and I had the same conversation, is that, I'm going to dig to get the story out of you. And it's going to bring some stuff back. And so, sometimes it's cathartic, sometimes it's not, but it is a symptom of what happens when they go back and have to relive this.
It's an important topic for Ryan and I to address PTS. We do all the time on our podcast. It's mentioned all the time. And one of the things that Ryan and I didn't realize when we first started interviewing World War II veterans like 20 years ago is, we heard what a lot of people have said. I'm sure you guys have heard this as well. A lot of times the vets would say, this is the first time I've talked about it. There sometimes be family members in the room, and after the interview, they would say things to us like he or she never said these things to us before. What we started to realize is that just having someone that they could talk to about it was a big deal. A lot of the veterans oftentimes didn't get help until they were in their 70s or 80s, and then they would go to the VA to talk about it. Kevin, you mentioned being able to write about it and talk to other people. What about you, Lucky? You said that you really didn't start talking about it until 50 years after the war when you kind of went on a lecture circuit. Was that good medicine for you? Did that help you as well?
Oh, I think it did. Yeah.
Okay.
I think it did help me.
So, Ryan, I have one last question. Ryan, do you have any questions before we wrap this up?
I guess the one thing I wanted to mention is, Lucky, we have a mutual acquaintance. You know, remember, you have your friend named Randy Finfrock?
Yes.
I'm friends with Randy myself here in Tulsa. I live in Tulsa. And in Tulsa. I texted him earlier and told him that we were going to be interviewing you today. And he said to say hi, and he'll be calling you shortly. And then he also mentioned that in just a month, actually a little over a month and a day, you will be 102.
Yeah.
Correct.
So, I gotta say, you're in fantastic shape. And, if I can be as active and as vibrant as you are, just 10 years from now, I will be very happy with myself. So
hell, 10 years, I'm thinking now I can't remember things like
right.
He is. So. Oh my God. I mean, I guess I have a question for both Kevin and you, Lucky, and Lucky, we'll start with you. when you think back at your time in the 8th Air Force and, you know, being overseas, what sticks out after all this time? What are the sort of things that you remember the most?
Well, I'm just extremely proud that fate had me join the 8th Air Force and be a part of it. I'm proud to have served in the 8th Air Force and still am finding ways and means to perpetuate the legend of it through the Mighty 8th Museum in Savannah. Through the various activities of the 100th Bomb Group Foundation. So for many years, I didn't join or participate in that sort of remembrance because there was nobody else that I knew that was still living. All of the people that I met at reunions were relatives, or they were people who came to the group long after I did. And so we really had very little in common. And but now I realize the importance of relating these facts to successive generations as being significant for the freedoms that we all enjoy today, and that it is it behooves us to remember the sacrifices, some the ultimate sacrifices that were made, so that they weren't made in vain.
You articulate that in the afterword in the book very clearly, and I thought that was courageous as well. The whole book is courageous. It really is. And Kevin, I'll end it, you know, with any words from you. So you've had a chance to get to know Lucky. You've connected when we wrote this book. I've already commented multiple times about how real it is. You know, I mean, it's gritty, I guess you could say. What do you hope when you were writing this book and making it available, what were you hoping the message would be? What did you want to share with people?
I don't know. I don't work that way. I was just hoping he'd like it, to be honest. At the end of the day, though, I think our intent from the beginning was to put a human face, to give readers a chance to experience the air war in a way that they may not have experienced before, to try to get out of the excitement of the planes and get into the sacrifice of the men. And I hope that we got there. And I hope that people take away a deeper understanding of what it took to climb into those cockpits and to do the things I had to do in order to secure the victory.
Okay. I'm not going to lie. I've got a million other questions, but you guys are in the Eastern time zone. I'm in the Mountain time zone. I've got 2 hours on you. You guys must be getting tired. You must be getting hungry. So I'm going to let you go. But I mean, Lucky, if we wanted to reach out to you and just ask you some questions about stuff, would you be okay with that?
If you can get me. I'm currently on a pretty fast track.
I'm sure.
Tony, and I'm amazed at the avalanche of requests that have flowed in since the release of the documentary. And truthfully, I'm really hard pressed for time. Because I'm due someplace right now.
Okay.
I'm going to have to sign off. So nice being with you, and thanks again.
No, thank you, sir. Lucky. We appreciate it. Well, Lucky mentioned about how busy he is right now. Yeah. I can't, Ryan, thank you enough how grateful we are for you making your time and his time available to us. Mm-hmm. Are you being rolled into this tsunami that is Masters of the Air as well, since you've written the book about one of the few survivors left in the 8th Air Force?
Not really. I mean, Orloff and I have exchanged texts. He's one of the creators, mostly congratulatory stuff. I mean, that was in production and while we were working on the book. So, you know, there was talk about, you know, getting some of the information from the book around the Bremen mission. But if you recall last episode, that was the Bremen mission, but they told it through the eyes of Yeagan instead of Cleven.
Yes.
And so the fact that you weren't on the mission, I don't think they really needed much from me. So I'm working on a book now about a guy named Jerry Sage, who you're not going to see him, but he was in Stalag Luft 3. He's captured in North Africa, and he's an OSS operative who was mistaken as a pilot, and he shows up in Stalag Luft 3. He falls in with the British early in the war, and he is part of the Great Escape, the guy that did the Great Escape. But he is the character, or he is loose. The character that Steve McQueen plays in the movie is loosely based on Jerry Sage. And so this will be the true story of that character. The book actually breaks into three distinct sections, and I think it'll be an interesting, you know, you'll have the OSS, creation of the OSS in the beginning, sort of that kind of spy versus spy thing. And then, you know, when he gets captured, he becomes this irritant, and he decides that his mission then is to torment the Germans. And so he does that. And then he eventually escapes as they're moving all the POWs west to get away from the Soviets. He escapes in Poland and spends about a month in Poland witnessing the reoccupation by the Soviets. And that is probably my favorite part of the book, because you don't really get that book very often, and to see it through his eyes, and it influences his future, because he, you know, throughout the book, you'll hear him, he'll talk about, he wants to get out and be a teacher. But after he sees what the Soviets do to Poland, he's getting ready. He's training up to go fight the Japanese when they drop the bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And he realizes he can't, with the atomic age coming, dawn of the atomic age, and the threat of the Soviets, he can't leave the military service. And he ends up staying in until he's a colonel in the special forces. He personifies that American kind of cowboy, like, I'm going to defy you, and you can't stop me. So it's sort of he's a fun guy to write about, because he is so kind of gregarious. Early on, there's an anthropologist who ends up pioneering the manure bombs that the OSS used to spread all over the road to slow down the German advance. And he's teamed up with Jerry Sage, and he describes Jerry Sage as an Achilles-like character. He feels like he's this like super warrior who is like bigger than life. And so, but he's a different guy by the end of the book, which makes the book, you know, an entry point. It makes him human, because if you read a lot of what they write about Jerry Sage right after the war, he takes on this bigger persona. They make him into a bigger hero. Not that he isn't, but it's almost fictional, where the reality of the guy that ends up becoming a teacher in South Carolina is, I think, a much more interesting character, much more interesting person.
Oh, that's so, it's the first.
I can't wait to read that. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. It's all. Well, you're an awesome author, Kevin. And
thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll be buying more of your books. I just like reading generally, and No Easy Day feels like kind of the next one that I'm going to probably plow through. All right, yeah. Kevin. Well, hey, man, enjoy the rest of your evening. And it was great getting to know you a little bit.
Thanks for your time today.
Thanks. No, too easy. Let me know what I can do to help. And thanks for the help.
Thanks, Kevin. Take care.
See y'all. Okay.
Well, there you have it, Warrior Next Door listeners. An amazing interview with an amazing man, 102-year-old John Lucky Luckadoo, who has been featured recently in the Tom Hanks narrated Bloody 100th documentary, which was just created and is a coda to the Masters of the Air series on Apple TV. And I just hope that that as you guys have listened to this, you realized how special this is to be able to have someone like John still with us in 2024, to be able to offer us some firsthand experiences and insights and lessons from a period of our history that we hope we never have to repeat again. So this wraps up the John Lucky Luckadoo episodes or series, and we got plenty more on tap in the coming weeks, so please stick around, please join us, please keep supporting our show. Take care. Well, I don't normally do a post roll during or after the final episode of a series, but we were starting to get a lot more comments than we have in the past as the show grows. And I want to make sure that I can share them with our audience. You might find them interesting. You might be interested to know that we actually care about your comments. So Kyle writes in about the video that I put together about Tony and Ryan walk the likely path of Bill's assault on D-Day, which I mentioned a bit last week in the post roll about Ryan and I probably most likely walking along the same path that Bill did when he assaulted the beach at Normandy back in 1944. And Kyle just wrote, "Y'all awesome." And anytime I have a chance to put a y'all on the air, I'm going to do it. Here's another one from, we did an Air 8 edition where we shared the interview that we had with Sarah Westerholm. Sarah Westerholm is the granddaughter of Leo Westerholm, who we featured in The Warrior Next Door. He was a 101st Airborne Trooper who was captured on D-Day and stuffed into a POW camp and just had an absolutely horrific experience there, not just in the POW camp, but when it was liberated. There were a number of things that occurred to him that were deeply unsettling. So if you get a chance, please listen to that. But someone wrote in on that episode that we had where we featured Sarah, and it was from Kyle, and he wrote, "Leo's story is one of the best. At least he's one of the better storytellers. My grandpa was in the 506th and jumped that night. He was only 19 years old. Listening to Leo gave me a sense of what my grandpa went through. I got to hear a little bit around the time that Saving Private Ryan came out, but I was only 10 years old then. I would have had a vastly different series of questions as an adult, and I'm not able to ask those questions anymore. I totally understand what this lady is saying. Thank you, Mr. Leo, for telling your story in a way that only you could have told." And he was an amazing storyteller. And just a reminder for those who maybe had not listened to the series, the one episode series that we did with the Sarah Westerholm interview, basically she was looking online for information about her grandfather, about Leo. And because on our website, we create a separate page for every person that we feature on our podcast, and that page has links to our podcast, to the YouTube videos, and to any memoirs that they may have shared with us, which Leo did. She was able to rediscover her grandfather and listen to him again. And I can't tell you how important that is to Ryan and I to know that maybe some of these veterans that we're featuring, that some great grandfather some great grandchild or daughter will stumble into this someday and get a chance to, you know, kind of resurrect some of those memories or be able to learn more about someone in their lives that they were too young to really appreciate at the time. So that's all I have. Look forward to hopefully all you guys join us next week for some more incredible content. Take care.